Production. Recorded live.
And I heard another voice from heaven saying, Come out from my people, that ye be not partakers of her sins, and that ye receive not of her plagues. For her sins have reached unto heaven, and God hath remembered her iniquities. Fellow Adamites, we are seeing the cracks emerge in Babylon. We are seeing the cracks spread. I don't believe it will be too long now before we hear Babylon the Great is fallen. And Yahweh willing, we shall all be there to witness it, and all the world shall bear witness to the power of Yahweh. If you have not begun to prepare for the things which are to come, the things which you are already starting to see happen, then you had best do so now. Now is the time to make preparations, gather supplies, make plans, and focus your efforts to keep on the straight and narrow path. Be right with the Heavenly Father, and He shall bring you through the plagues that await this doomed nation. Today is January the 2nd, 2011, Sunday, and Bill Fink is joining us again for the second installment of Hitler's Declaration of War on the United States of America. How are you doing tonight, sir?
Hello, praise Yahweh.
Absolutely, praise Yahweh. And when last we left off, we covered how the U.S. was using diplomacy and, in some instances, their Navy to wage basically an undeclared war against Germany, with resulting incidents such as the USS Kearney and the USS Reuben James, which were respectively damaged and sunk while they were attacking German U-boats.
Well, absolutely. The U.S. was doing everything it could to get into a war with Germany, just like England had done everything it could to get into a war with Germany. The bankers wanted Germany exterminated. That's the bottom line. And everything that people knew then about Germany came to them through the Jewish media, the Jewish-controlled media of the 1930s and 40s. Yes, the Jews already controlled the media in the 1920s and 30s and 40s. And they controlled very influential media outlets before that. They bought the New York Times in 1895. And actually, the Jew that bought the New York Times came from, I think, from Tennessee. And he was the son of carpetbaggers and came up from Tennessee to New York to buy the New York Times and turn it into what it is today through Jewish influence and the banking system and everything else that they – and every other perfidious trick that they have. I published something on the Mein Kampf site this week. It's been around. It's nothing new, but I'm trying to collect all this information in one place. That's my purpose for that site. And it's a last appeal to reason. Adolf Hitler actually gave this speech before the Reichstag, July 19th, 1940, and a lot of it was an appeal to the sensibilities of the British people and trying to prevent a war with Britain. And he dropped – he had thousands and thousands of copies of this speech dropped over London by air. And there's a reproduction of it on the front page of the Mein Kampf site now with the text of that speech. But I have something else I wanted to illustrate. We'll probably cover this at length. We probably should cover this at length later in this series, right?
Yes.
This is an article from a 2004 Barnes Review I'd like to read a couple of paragraphs from. The more I read, the more I'm convinced that England and France – well, France was a little reluctant – but England especially and the banking powers, the Jews behind England, you know, the Jews had the world by the balls in 1929. They controlled Germany through the Weimar Republic. They controlled Britain. They controlled Russia. And they controlled the United States. And they had us all in a state of depression. And Adolf Hitler rose up in Germany and took Germany back from the clutches of the Jews in 1933. I don't care what anybody says about Hitler being a Jewish agent. They're just fools. Because the Jews had full control of Germany from the Weimar Republic.
Why would they give it up?
Well, right. Why would they give it? It's ridiculous. It makes no sense whatsoever. When Hitler tore Germany out of the clutches of the Jews, they wanted to destroy him from that very time. They published and openly in media papers that they declared war. Judea declares war on Germany.
Exactly. What would these clowns have us believe, that the Jews had Germany in a vice grip and they brought Hitler in there to throw them out, to remove suspicion that they were running the show? That's like cheating on a test but failing so the teacher doesn't get suspicious.
Well, absolutely. Well, basically, the English and the French pumped up the Polish ego and pumped up Poland and instigated that they prodded Poland into instigating a war with Germany. They used Poland to instigate a war with Germany. I'd like to read a couple of paragraphs so that people have a background of what Hitler was up against and why he had to get into this war. And this is from a 2004 Barnes Review and an article by an Alex S. Perry Jr., which is actually the whole gist of the article was that Adolf Hitler is an overlooked candidate for the Nobel Prize, the Peace Prize. That's basically the title of the article. And he's giving the arguments of what great lengths Hitler went to avoid war in 1939, even though the media was saying exactly the opposite, while they used Poland to instigate war. It's just incredible, the Hegelian dialectic they set up.
Who's media?
Well, exactly. It was the Jewish media. The Jews founded CBS. They had already owned the Washington Post and the New York Times were the two most influential papers in the country at this time. Time magazine, Life magazine, a lot of the big magazines were controlled by the Jews. Once they got the ability to create our money, they got the ability to build up the businesses they wanted to build up and to destroy the businesses they wanted to destroy. That's the bottom line. And a few companies that were Jew-wise, like the Ford Motor Company and Colonel McCormick's Chicago Tribune, those companies were for a long time able to stay independent and fend themselves off from the Jews. But those companies were few and far between. And the Chicago Tribune, it was a big paper in the Midwest, and it was a lot more objective than the East Coast papers, but it just didn't have the same amount of influence over the country's politicians. Or at least enough of them. I'd like to read this. Poland, Perry starts his article out by saying, Poland delivered the first blow, and Hitler announced, since dawn today, we are shooting back. Hitler's taking a defensive position against Poland. Poland is the aggressor in World War II. Poland started the war. When he spoke to the Reichstag on September 1st, 1939, that's what he said. Since dawn today, we are shooting back. When Hitler, shooting back is not the statement of an aggressor. When Hitler attacked, Donald Day said, Poland got exactly what she deserved. None of Poland's immediate neighbors felt sorry for her. Poland had conducted a policy of terror. Ethnic Germans living on German soil that had been given to Poland at the end of World War II by the Versailles Peace Treaty, that's a joke, right? Had been so mistreated that 2 million left the area for Germany and elsewhere. They were driven from what had been their homeland long before World War II. It was historically Prussia, right? All of what we know is northern Poland today.
Are we talking about the provinces of Silesia?
Well, right, Silesia and right, there's a great strip of land along the rivers that were handed over to Poland. Leon de Grel, a young Belgian political leader in the 1930s, who later joined Hitler's hardest fighting unit, the Waffen-SS, with over 400,000 other non-German European volunteers, says, of all the crimes of World War II, one never hears about the wholesale massacres that occurred in Poland just before the war. Well, of course not. The Western media suppressed that news. It wasn't news to them. That they kept that out of the papers of the West. Thousands of German men, women, and children were massacred in the most horrendous fashion by press-enraged mobs. It was the newspapers in Poland raising the ire of the Polish people against the ethnic Germans.
Hitler decided those papers were.
Well, right, exactly. Those papers were all Jewish-controlled, just like the Jewish-controlled papers that helped incite the Bolshevik Revolution in Russia in 1917. Hitler decided to halt the slaughter, and he rushed to the rescue. Young German boys, when captured by Poles, were castrated. William Joyce, nicknamed Lord Haw-Haw by the British propaganda, that this man was a Brit, William Joyce, and the British the British media, because he understood what was going on and took the side of the Germans, the British media just ridiculed him, right?
And they killed him after the war.
Yes. He was nicknamed Lord Ha-Ha by British propaganda, became a German citizen, and took up for the German cause. He described the conditions of the Germans who were living in Poland because of the Versailles Treaty. Quote, German men and women were hunted like wild beasts through the streets of Bromberg. When they were caught, they were mutilated and torn to pieces by the Polish mob. Every day the butchery increased. Thousands of Germans fled from their homes in Poland with nothing more than the clothes they wore. Moreover, there was no doubt that the Polish army was making plans for the massacre of Danzig. On the nights of August 25th to August 31st, inclusive, there occurred, besides innumerable attacks on civilians of German blood, 44 perfectly authenticated acts of armed violence against German official persons and property. These incidents took place either on the border or inside German territory. On the night of August 31st, a band of Polish desperados actually occupied the German broadcasting station at Gliwice. Now it was clear that unless German troops marched at once, not a man, woman, or child of German blood within Polish territory could reasonably expect to avoid persecution and slaughter.
The mainstream historians claim that the SS and the Gestapo staged that attack on the radio station, put a bunch of concentration camp inmates in Polish uniforms, shot them all dead, stuffed them in the radio station, but the mainstream historians are very quiet on the issue of massacres. I wonder, did the Gestapo stage the massacre of 20,000 Germans inside Poland?
Well, right, exactly. That they, I guess the same SS and Gestapo staged the whole Holocaust, right? Due to Poland's atrocious acts against the German people, Hitler declared to British Ambassador Sir Neville Henderson on August 25, 1939, Poland's provocations have become intolerable. So Poland delivered the first blow, not Germany. The first blow was important to the United States in its war with Japan. It gave the United States the right and justification to do whatever it was necessary to defeat the Japanese. But Germany did not have this right with Poland, even after Poland had delivered the first blow. What fair-minded man, if he knew the true facts involved in a Polish situation, could blame Hitler for his retaliatory attack on Poland? Poland, if any other nation ever did, deserved exactly what Germany gave her in return. But Hitler did not even want to do what he had to do. No sooner than Hitler began protecting German people inside Poland, he was ready to stop all hostilities and began peace negotiations. Prince Sturdza, S-T-U-R-D-Z-A, narrates, only hours after the outbreak of hostilities between Germany and Poland, Mussolini, renewing his efforts for peace, proposed to all the interested powers an immediate suspension of hostilities and the immediate convocation of a conference between the great powers in which Poland would also participate. Mussolini's proposals were, without any delay, accepted by all governments concerned except Great Britain.
Well, of course, the Rothschilds in London won't allow anybody to accept that.
They wanted to destroy Germany, and this was their pretext. Before war broke out, Britain's ambassador to Berlin, Sir Neville Chamberlain, on August 30th, 1939, said in his final report of Germany's proposed basis for negotiations, those proposals are, in general, not too unreasonable. Even Pierre and René Gosset, in their rabid anti-German book Hitler, declare, quote, it was a proposal of extreme moderation. It was, in fact, an offer that no Allied statesman could have rejected in good faith. As early as January 1941, Hitler was making extraordinary efforts to come to peace terms with England. He offered England generous terms. He offered if Britain would assume an attitude of neutrality to withdraw from all of France, to leave Holland and Belgium, to evacuate Norway and Denmark, and to support British and French industries by buying their products. His proposal had many other favorable points for England and Western Europe, but England's officials did not want peace. They wanted war. Had they not celebrated their declaration of war by laughing, joking, and drinking beer? And if we see that there's a picture on the I posted on the front page of the Mein Kampf site of a it's in this Appeal to Reason article. And it shows a British civil servant holding up this last appeal to reason by Adolf Hitler that was dropped over the city of London by British by German planes to appeal to the British people to avoid the war. It was one of the moves Hitler used to avoid the war. And this man has a huge smile on his face, like he's just laughing at the Germans and Hitler. And it's incredible. It's like pigs at the trough, right?
The Germans were dropping leaflets, not bombs, basically, until the British bombed Berlin. The Germans had confined their air attacks on Britain to factories and purely military targets, such as airfields and radar stations. And then the British flew a deep raid into Germany, dropped hundreds of bombs on Berlin, so Hitler responded with terror bombing against London and other cities. But we never hear about that. We always just hear that the Germans were horrible and they wanted to bomb Britain into the ground.
Well, I'd like to read one more paragraph from this article before we get back to Hitler's declaration of war, and this sort of sets the stage. Hitler is definitely showing in his statements here his love for Western culture as a whole, and we'll see that also is expressed in his declaration of war on America. Hitler allowed the British to escape at Dunkirk. He did not want to fight England. German General Blumentritt states why Hitler allowed the British to escape. Quote, "He then astonished us by speaking with admiration of the British Empire, of the necessity for its existence, and the civilization that Britain had brought into the world. He remarked with a shrug of the shoulders that the creation of the empire had been achieved by means that were often harsh, but where there is planning, there are shavings flying, or perhaps planing is meant there, but there are two ends. He compared the British Empire with the Catholic Church, saying they were both essential elements in the stability of the world. He said that all he wanted from Britain was that she should acknowledge Germany's position on the continent. The return of Germany's lost colonies, would be desirable but not essential," meaning the colonies in Africa, right?
And that was just Tanzania and Southwest Africa and I believe Cameroon. So we're not talking about a lot of holdings here.
And he would even offer to support Britain with troops if she should be involved in any difficulties anywhere.
But Britain wasn't looking for military support anywhere. They were looking to destroy Germany because that's what the Jews that controlled the British Empire told them to do.
Well, exactly. Hitler was a lover of Britain, and the British loved the Jewish money a lot more, didn't they? And it's still that way. The British Israel World Federation is still that way, right? That their leadership, anyway, it's incredible. Well, that's I just wanted to give that background into the beginnings of this, the real beginnings of the Second World War. And as we read Hitler here in his Declaration of War on America, talk about the importance of understanding this as a struggle between European civilization and what basically boils down to the white race, even though he doesn't frame it that way, and the Asian hordes from the East and the African hordes who had already tried to destroy Europe on several occasions. Well, the English and the Americans are very short-sighted when it comes to history.
Mm-hmm.
And we'd rather destroy ourselves.
Not to mention the French.
Ourselves.
Again, once again, in World War II, the French unleashed hundreds of thousands of North Africans and Cameroonian and Moroccan soldiers all across Italy and into Germany, too. Just like they did in World War I, how they sent all those black soldiers into the Rhineland.
Well, right. And Hitler talked about, in Mein Kampf, about the French planting niggers in the Rhine, which is absolutely repulsive, right?
Absolutely. And the Pope actually asked the Americans not to let black soldiers go into Rome. He said they would rape Italian women. But the French actually used entire divisions of Moroccan soldiers and other French African colonial troops, and they basically rampaged up and down Italy.
Well, right. Well, they've destroyed the flower of France in the Napoleonic Wars and World War I and the wars of the 1870s. And they've destroyed their own race. They had to hire mercenaries. That's the sign of any fallen empire, right? It's the sign of the failure of the American empire. Because now we enlist these Mexicans and these that these basic, that these short brown squat monsters from South America, what we enlist them into our armed services and tell them if they serve 4 years in Iraq, they get citizenship. That's the first sign of decline of any imperialist nation. When that happens, any imperialist and any nation that's become an empire, when it starts recruiting mercenaries from alien sources, you know that it's on its way down the tubes.
Absolutely. The French that's
exactly what Rome did. Rome freed the slaves so that they could tax them because citizens paid more taxes than slaves.
And the French army today, it's about as French as the French soccer team or the French football team.
Well, right. I have that posted somewhere, that picture you sent me, and it shows the French, that the all-white French football team from the 1950s and the entirely non-white French football team from recent years, and it's absolutely repulsive. That there's not a drop of French blood in the whole picture. Okay, would you like to start reading with page four of this paper?
All right, and the last paragraph last week was, "And from this Europe, there have not only been settlements in other parts of the world, but intellectual, spiritual, and cultural fertilization as well, a fact that anyone realizes who is willing to acknowledge the truth rather than deny it. Thus, it was not England that cultivated the continent, but rather Anglo-Saxon and Norman branches of the Germanic nation that moved from our continent to the British island and made possible her development, which is certainly unique in history. In the same way, it was not America that discovered Europe, but the other way around. And all that which America did not get from Europe may seem worthy of admiration to a Jewified mixed race, but Europe regards that merely as symptomatic of decay in artistic and cultural life, the product of Jewish or Negroid blood mixture."
And that's the promotion of the Jews by the Jews, which they constantly do, of everything that's vile and foul, and they love to promote these aboriginal, what's the term for it? The noble savages.
And they actually claim that abstract art is really art and it should be lauded and praised.
Right. And the underlying thread here of Hitler's declaration of war on America, which he makes very reluctantly, is that, hey, we are all the same race. We're all brothers. What the hell are we fighting each other for? Hitler knew that. And America and the British, that they were whores for the Jews instead. What can I say? I can't face it any other way.
American culture, though, is inferior because America's allowed it to become so.
Absolutely. Our inventiveness and our ability to make inventions and to advance technology is superior to Europe the last 100, 150 years. And that's only because we lived in a much freer system.
Mm-hmm. And we basically got the best of Europe in the way of immigration.
Yes, to a great degree. But the we live in a much freer system where Europe is very socialist and still very class divided, and well it was through World War II anyway. And it's entirely different atmosphere. It didn't nurture the liberty that we have here in America to have the leisure time in order to devise great things.
Europe was conducive to innovation.
Right. The European economic systems weren't the last 150, not as much as ours. But they've made a lot of great advancements. I mean, the diesel engine was invented by Germans. There have been a lot of great inventions in Europe, but I believe that we were able to surpass them technologically because what we had a kinder environment to allow the nurturing of new development and invention.
All right, my deputies, men of the German Reichstag, I have to make these remarks because this struggle, which became obviously unavoidable in the early months of this year, and which the German Reich, above all, is called upon this time to lead, also greatly transcends the interests of our own people and nation. When the Greeks once stood against the Persians, they defended more than just Greece. When the Romans stood against the Carthaginians, they defended more than just Rome. When the Roman and Germanic peoples stood together against the Huns, they defended more than just the West. When German emperors stood against the Mongols, they defended more than just Germany. And when Spanish heroes stood against Africa, They defended not just Spain, but all of Europe as well. In the same way, Germany does not fight today just for itself, but for our entire continent. And it is an auspicious sign that this realization is today so deeply rooted in the subconscious of most European nations that they participate in this struggle either with open expressions of support or with streams of volunteers. When the German and Italian armies took the offensive against Yugoslavia and Greece on April 6th of this year, that was the prelude to the great struggle in which we now find ourselves. That is because the revolt in Belgrade on March 26, 1941, which led to the overthrow of the former Prince Regent and his government, determined the further development of events in that part of Europe. Although Britain played a major role in that coup, Soviet Russia played the main role. What I had refused to Mr. Molotov during his visit to Berlin, Stalin believed he could obtain indirectly against our will by revolutionary activity. Without regard for the treaties they had signed, the Bolshevik rulers expanded their ambitions. The Soviet Treaty of Friendship with the new revolutionary regime in Belgrade showed very quickly just how threatening the danger had become. The achievements of the German armed forces in this campaign were honored in the German Reichstag on May 4, 1941. At that time, though, I was not able to reveal that we were very quickly approaching a confrontation with a state, Soviet Union, that did not attack at the time of the campaign in the Balkans only because its military buildup was not yet complete and because it was not able to use its airfields as a result of the mud from melting snow at this time of year, which made it impossible to use the runways. My deputies, men of the Reichstag, when I became aware of the possibility of a threat to the east of the Reich in 1940 through secret reports from the British House of Commons and by observations of Soviet-Russian troop movements on our frontiers, I immediately ordered the formation of many new armored, motorized, and infantry divisions. The human and material resources for them were abundantly available. In this regard, I can make only one promise to you, my deputies, and to the entire German nation. While people in democratic countries understandably talk a lot about armaments, in National Socialist Germany, all the more will actually be produced. It has been that way in the past, and it is not any different now. Whenever decisive action has to be taken, we will have, with each passing year, more and above all better quality weapons. We realized very quickly that under no circumstances could we allow the enemy the opportunity to strike first into our heart. Nevertheless, in this case, the decision to attack the Soviet Union was a very difficult one. When the writers for the Democratic newspapers now declare that I would have thought twice before attacking if I had known the strength of the Bolshevik adversaries, they show that they do not understand either the situation or me. I have not sought war. To the contrary, I have done everything to avoid conflict. But I would forget my duty and my conscience if I were to do nothing in spite of the realization that a conflict had become unavoidable, because I regarded Soviet Russia as the gravest danger not only for the German Reich, but for all of Europe. I decided, if possible, to give the order myself to attack a few days before the outbreak of this conflict. A truly impressive amount of authentic material is now available which confirms that a Soviet attack was intended. We are also sure about when this attack was to take place. In view of this danger, the extent of which we are perhaps only now truly aware, I can only thank the Lord God that He enlightened me in time and has given me the strength to do what must be done. Millions of German soldiers may thank Him for their lives and all of Europe for its existence. Now, has Stalin ever made a reference to God in any of his speeches? Or Churchill or Rosenfeld, for that matter. If I recall, Rosenfeld said that the American people in their righteous might will overcome and will prevail, and he didn't make any references to God helping them. He said that the American people would do it on their own. It just shows you where his power comes from. I may say this today. If this wave of more than 20,000 tanks, hundreds of divisions, tens of thousands of artillery pieces, along with more than 10,000 airplanes, had not been kept from being set in motion against the Reich, Europe would have been lost.
And let me, Roosevelt, there's a lot of contention over whether or not he was actually a Jew. Stalin was a Jew. It can be demonstrated that he was a Jew. I don't care how badly the Jews deny it. They want to deny it because they'd rather use him as a model anti-Semite to prove that the horrors of Bolsheviks somehow weren't Jewish. The Jews were responsible for all the horrors of the Bolshevik and Soviet regimes. Stalin indeed was a Jew. He did get rid of a lot of Jews, but he merely did that to eliminate his competition, and Jews do that all the time. Churchill, I don't know if Churchill ever, I think I do vaguely remember him mentioning God in a speech or two, and that doesn't mean it was sincerely, right? But Roosevelt, I mean, when he said the only thing we have to fear is fear itself, he was being absolutely arrogant and unchristian, not only in that statement, but in many of his statements. And I have an article, I actually have what we should probably eventually move on to this next, and once we finish Hitler's declaration of war against the United States, I have material concerning Hitler's declaration of war concerning the Soviet Union, and I have a lot of material concerning Operation Barbarossa, and one of them is an excellent article that was written long before the Suvorov book came out, right, by a gentleman named Dan Michaels, that basically proved that the Soviets were about to strike Europe, and that Hitler struck the Soviets as a preemptive measure. And I also have Suvorov's book here and a lot of good material from him. Suvorov wrote a lot of material, citing a lot of material from actual Soviet papers and archives that prove that Russia was about to strike Europe and had their designs on all of Europe. It wasn't Hitler. The Jews were crying that Hitler wanted to conquer the world, so Germany had to be destroyed, when in truth, it was the Jews that conquered the world, and they were able to do it in part because we destroyed Germany.
And I want to point out, too, that at the time Operation Barbarossa began, the Soviets either had on the border with the German Reich or within about 100 miles of that border, they had 3.2 million men, 15,000 tanks, and 40,000 aircraft.
Well, absolutely. There's a lot of documentation, and we should probably go on to discuss Hitler's declaration of war against the Soviets and the entire Operation Barbarossa scenario, because Adolf Hitler threw Germany on the pyre in order to save Europe from the Soviet hordes. And Winston Churchill and Franklin Roosevelt destroyed Adolf Hitler, which Adolf Hitler would have never been destroyed. Nazi Germany would have never been destroyed if his only foe was the Soviet Union. We would have no Soviet Union.
By
1944, we'd have no Soviet Union.
He was busy fighting the great red menace in the east, and the west plunged a dagger into his back.
Well, absolutely. But at Yalta, Roosevelt and Churchill handed the Soviet Union half of Europe anyway. But if it weren't for Hitler, they would have had it all, and it would not have been pretty.
Absolutely. And I just want to point out that the Germans were outnumbered 5-1 in tanks and 10-1 in aircraft. They had a slight advantage in terms of infantry personnel, but that's only because they had so many Romanians, Hungarians, and Finns and other states that were helping them, since it was a huge united effort against the Soviet Union. And I think they easily would have won in that year had it not been for the Western aid to the Soviets, the bombing campaign against Germany, and the Lend-Lease, which, by the way, we've never gotten back. They just basically gave away trillions of dollars worth of America's productive talent to the Soviet Union.
Well, today I posted on ChrisTheGenia.org in an article that I called Judaism with the Mask Off, right? And this is what I wrote. It's only a paragraph. The devils are completely out of the closet, and nobody seems to care or even notice. The greatest crimes in history have been perpetrated by Jews, and now the Jews are openly celebrating the perpetrators. In the first video, and I have a video here on the front page, and in the first video below, we see the trailer for a new movie produced by Jews which celebrates the memory of the Jewish mass murderer, Leon Trotsky, whose real name at birth was Lev Davidovich Bronstein. However, in the second video, entitled Harvest of Despair, we see the real story about the Bolshevik starvation of the Christian peoples of the Ukraine, both before and after Stalin. And I refer people to the Jews in Russia book on the Mein Kampf site by, I'm sorry, I forget his name right now. I would have to go look.
Is that the Suvorov guy you were talking about?
No, that's Andrew Ivan Dyke. the Jews in Russia and the USSR, proving that all the Bolsheviks were Jews, and I refer people to the Russian number one report. But basically, this video is a trailer for a movie, and the Jews are celebrating the legacy of Trotsky in this movie.
His legacy is mayhem, death, Bolshevism, and oppression.
Well, no, his legacy is heroism and sticking up for the working man and the oppressed. Which that's his legacy according to the Jews.
Well,
we know that 20 million people died because of Leon Trotsky, maybe 30 million people died because of Leon Trotsky, horrible deaths, and that the rest of Christianity in Russia, the Christian white race of Russia, was absolutely oppressed.
Read Russia number one, that's his legacy.
Absolutely. And the Jews are celebrating it. So I dug out this this Harvest of Despair, which is it's actually an old documentary, and it's an excellent documentary by mainstream sources on the horrors that occurred in the Ukraine and in Russia itself under the Bolshevik regime and later under Stalin.
All right. Continuing with the speech. Several nations have been destined to prevent or parry this blow through the sacrifice of their blood. If Finland, for one, had not immediately decided for the second time to take up weapons, then the comfortable bourgeois life of other Nordic countries would quickly have been extinguished. And it's interesting that Finland went to war basically to protect themselves and the rest of Scandinavia, yet Sweden today has adopted basically Soviet communism without a shot being fired. They didn't do anything to prevent it.
Right, exactly. And the Finns fought the Russians, the Soviets, I really should say, in open warfare on the plains of on the frozen tundra of Finland and basically kicked their asses.
Winter war.
Right. They lost some territory, but Russia wanted all of Finland and couldn't get it. The Finns successfully resisted. And that was a very heroic moment in Finnish history. But Finland may as well have lost to the Soviets now, though the way the political climate is there also.
The Soviets attacked Finland in 1939 with almost 1 million men, 6,000 tanks, and 4,000 aircraft. They lost over 3,000 tanks, 500 aircraft, and about 300,000 personnel.
Well, the Finns beat them. You know, the Afghanis beat them, but they had a lot of help from the CIA, right? The Finns didn't have help from anybody.
Well, some countries sent volunteers. Mainly, I think Germany sent some volunteers, and a lot of people sent supplies.
Well, Germany couldn't send anything openly because they technically still were at allies of the Soviets.
But that didn't stop the Soviet Union from betraying the alliance by trying to undermine Germany and the Balkans.
Well, right. But Hitler expressed great regret that he had too much honor to break the alliance with the alliance that he had signed, that the treaty that he had signed. He had too much honor to break it to come to the aid of the Finns. And he expressed deep regret over that.
Since the Germans actually took their treaty obligations seriously.
Yes. And the Jews always make their treaties with their fingers crossed behind their backs.
Well, they've already sworn the Kol HaNidre, so their treaty is worth their word, which is nothing.
Right.
If the German Reich, with its soldiers and weapons, had not stood against this opponent, a storm would have burned over Europe that would have eliminated once and for all time, and in all its intellectual palpity and traditional stupidity, the laughable British idea of the European balance of power. If the Slovaks, Hungarians, and Romanians had not also acted to defend this European world, then the Bolshevik hordes would have poured over the Danube countries, as did once the swarms of Attila's Huns and Soviet Tatars and Mongols, would then, on the open country, by the Ionian Sea, force a revision of the Treaty of Moncreux regarding the Dardanelles Strait. If Italy, Spain, and Croatia had not sent their divisions, then a European defense front would not have arisen that proclaims the concept of a new Europe and thereby powerfully inspires all other nations as well. Because of this awareness of danger, volunteers have come from Northern and Western Europe, Norwegians, Danes, Dutch, Flemish, Belgians, and even French. They have all given the struggle of the Allied forces of the Axis the character of a European crusade in the truest sense of the word. And I just want to point out that over 400,000 foreigners joined the Waffen-SS throughout World War II. Mostly French, Danish, Belgian, the Scandinavian countries, about 20,000 from Italy, and many from the Balkans. This is not yet the right time to speak of the planning and direction of this campaign. However, in a few sentences, I would like to say something about what has been achieved so far in this greatest conflict in history. Because of the enormous area involved, as well as the number and size of the events, individual impressions may be lost and forgotten. The attack began at dawn on June 22, 1941. With dauntless daring, the frontier fortifications that were meant to protect the Soviet Union build up against us from surprise attack were broken through. Grodno fell by June 23rd. On June 24th, following the capture of Brest-Litovsk, the fortress there was taken in combat, and Vilnius and Kunas in Lithuania were also taken. Daugavpilis in Latvia fell on June 26th. The first two great encirclement battles near Bilatovsk and Minsk were completed on July 10. We captured 324,000 prisoners of war, 3,332 tanks, and 1,809 artillery pieces. By July 13, the Stalin line had been broken through at almost every decisive point. Smolensk fell on July 16 after heavy fighting, and German and Romanian units were able to force their way across the Dniester River on July 19. The Battle of Smolensk ended on August 6 after many encircling operations. As a result, another 310,000 Russians were taken as prisoners. Moreover, 3,205 tanks and 3,120 artillery pieces were counted, either destroyed or captured. Just 3 days later, the fate of another Soviet army group was sealed. On August 9, in the Battle of Uman, another 103,000 Soviet prisoners of war were taken, 317 tanks, and 1,100 artillery pieces were either destroyed or captured. Nikolaev in the Ukraine fell on August 13, and Kherson was taken on the 21st. On the same day, the battle near Gomel ended, resulting in 84,000 prisoners, as well as 144 tanks and 848 artillery pieces either captured or destroyed. The Soviet positions between the Ilmen and Papaias lakes were broken through on August 21st, while the bridgehead around Dnipropetrovsk fell into our hands on August 26th. On the 28th of that month, German troops entered Tallinn and Paldiski in Estonia after heavy fighting, while the Finns took Vyborg on the 20th. With the capture of Petrokurpost on September 8th, Leningrad was finally cut off from the south. By September 16th, bridgeheads across the Dnieper were formed, and on September 18th, Poltava fell into the hands of our soldiers. German units stormed the fortress of Kiev on September 19th, and on September 22nd, the conquest of the Baltic islands of Saaremaa, Oesel, was crowned by the capture of its capital. And now came the anticipated results of the greatest undertakings. The battle near Kiev was completed on September 27. Endless columns of 665,000 prisoners of war marched to the west. In the encircled area, 884 tanks and 3,178 artillery pieces were captured. The battle to break through the central area of the Eastern Front began on October 2nd, while the Battle of the Azov Sea was successfully completed on October 11th. Another 107,000 prisoners, 212 tanks, and 672 artillery pieces were counted. After heavy fighting, German and Romanian units were able to enter Odessa on October 16. The battle to break through the center of the Eastern Front, which had begun on October 2nd, ended on October 18th with a success that is unique in world history. The result was 663,000 prisoners of war, as well as 1,242 tanks, 5,452 artillery pieces, either destroyed or captured. The capture of Dogu was completed on October 21st. The industrial center of Kharkov was taken on October 24th. After heavy fighting, the Crimea was finally reached, and on November 2nd, the capital of Simferopol was stormed. On November 16th, the Crimea was overrun as far as Kerch. As of December 1st, the total number of captured Soviet-Russian prisoners of war was 3,806,865. The number of destroyed or captured tanks was 21,391. Artillery pieces, 32,541, and airplanes, 17,322. Does that sound like a peaceful power, the Soviet Union? They had all that on the German border.
And probably half of it was made in Detroit, right?
I'm sure most of those weapons were stamped made in the United States. During this same period of time, 2,191 British airplanes were shot down. the Navy sank 4,170,611 gross registered tons of shipping, and the Air Force sank 2,346,180 tons. Altogether, 6,516,791 gross registered tons were destroyed. And that represented approximately a third of the British merchant shipping at the time. And the Americans just built them a new merchant fleet, though.
I have here a Barnes Review article from 2003 written by Richard Tedder that starts out, I'm not going to read much of it, right? But it starts out, historians purport that Germany failed to conquer Soviet Russia in World War II largely because Adolf Hitler, the militarily, quote-unquote, ungifted amateur, consistently countermanded the operational plans of the German Army General Staff. An examination of his personal blueprint for the campaign and how the general subverted it reveals another side to the story. It's apparent, and Tedder puts a he puts forth a very good argument that two generals that disliked Adolf Hitler very much, General Walter von Brauchitsch and General Franz Halder, and their egos, that they did not, that they refused to carry out the war plan the way it was originally laid out, and basically they cost Germany the campaign in the East.
Walter von Brauchitsch was actually married to a woman that had used to, she was formerly a prostitute, I believe, and he was scandalized, and Hitler basically made him remove himself from public light. So Brauchitsch had an axe to grind against Hitler.
Well, right, and these men cost Hitler to cost Germany the campaign in the East, according to Tedder, and it's a very convincing article, and perhaps we'll cover it one day in the near future.
I don't know what the issue with Franz Halder is. I'd have to look into that. But when you said Walter von Brauchitsch, that name immediately came to mind since he had been involved. In fact, his wife had formerly been a known prostitute slash pornographer in Weimar, Germany.
Well, I wonder what she was.
And the Gestapo found out about that. And they basically told this guy that you need to resign or divorce your wife. I'm pretty sure that was Brauchitsch.
Well, we'll cover this article in the near future.
I'll look into that. I might be confusing him with another anti-Hitler general, since there were a number of guys that they had so many issues going on in their personal life, they were basically cruds that should have been booted out of the Wehrmacht.
Well, right, but the alternative was Ernst Röhm, right? We didn't need that.
All right. My deputies, my German people, these are sober facts and perhaps dry figures, but may they never be forgotten by history or vanish from the memory of our own German nation. For behind these figures are the achievements, sacrifices, and suffering, the heroism and readiness to die of millions of the best men of our own people and of the countries allied with us. Everything had to be fought for at the cost of health and life, and through struggle such as those back in the homeland can hardly imagine. And if you think about it, basically, 4 million Soviet soldiers were dead or captured at a cost of maybe a few hundred thousand Germans killed or wounded. I mean, that's a pretty good ratio there, wouldn't you say?
Well, absolutely. I mean, right, all war is a trade-off.
And they say Soviet losses were counted as almost 1 million killed, and that's documented kills only by the Soviet side. 3 million wounded, over 3.5 million captured. So that they basically lost effectively over 7 million personnel, and
they lost about 10-1, right, or probably better than that.
Absolutely, and they'd lost almost all of their tanks and aircraft. But Detroit was working hard to replace all that. Rosie the Riveter is hard at work to keep the Soviet war effort going.
Absolutely.
They have marched endless distances, tortured by heat and thirst, often bogged down with despair in the mud of bottomless dirt roads, exposed to the hardships of a climate that varies between the white and black seas, from the intense heat of July and August days to the winter storms of November and December, tormented by insects, suffering from dirt and pests, freezing in snow and ice, they fought. The Germans and the Finns, the Italians, Slovaks, Hungarians, Romanians, and Croatians, the volunteers from the northern and western European countries, in short, the soldiers of the Eastern Front. Today, I will not single out specific branches of the armed forces or praise specific leaders. They have all done their best, and yet truth and justice requires that something be mentioned again. As in the past, so also today, of all of our German men, fighting men in the uniform, the greatest burden of battle is borne by our ever-present infantry soldiers. From June 22nd to December 1st, the German army has lost in this heroic struggle 158,773 dead, 563,082 wounded, and 31,191 missing. The Air Force has lost 3,231 dead, 8,453 wounded, and 2,028 missing. The Navy, 310 dead, 232 wounded, and 115 missing. For the German forces altogether, 162,314 dead, 571,767 wounded, and 33,334 missing. That is the number of dead and wounded is somewhat more than double the number of those lost in the four-month-long battle of the Somme of the First World War in 1916, but somewhat less than half the number of missing in that battle. All the same, fathers and sons of our German people. And now, let me speak about another world, one that is represented by a man, Franklin Roosevelt, who likes to chat nicely at the fireside while nations and their soldiers fight in snow and ice. Above all, the man who is primarily responsible for this war. When the nationality problem in the former Polish state was growing ever more intolerable in 1939, I attempted to eliminate the unendurable conditions by means of a just agreement. For a certain time, it seemed as if the Polish government was seriously considering giving its approval to a reasonable solution. I may also add here that in all of these German proposals, nothing was demanded that had not previously belonged to Germany. In fact, we were willing to give up much that had belonged to Germany before the First World War. You will recall the dramatic events of that period, the steadily increasing numbers of victims among the ethnic Germans. You, my deputies, are best qualified to compare this loss of life with that of the present war. The military campaign in the East has so far cost the entire German armed forces about 160,000 dead, whereas during just a few months of peace in 1939, more than 62,000 ethnic Germans were killed, including some who were horribly tortured. There is no question that the German Reich had the right to protest against the situation on its border and to press for its elimination, if for no other reason than for its own security, particularly since we live in an age in which other countries, notably the United States and Britain, regard their security at stake even in foreign countries, foreign continents. In geographical terms, the problems to be resolved were not very important. Essentially, they involved Danzig, Gdansk, and a connecting link between the torn-away province of East Prussia and the rest of the Reich.
Gdansk is the Polish name for Danzig.
Yes.
And that's why I wanted to read this article I did at the beginning of this program on Poland's responsibility for the war to substantiate Hitler's claims here that, yes, Poland started the war, that they were murdering German civilians inside of Danzig and inside of Polish territory.
At the behest
People
of the Jew.
Right, at the behest of the Jew.
Of much greater concern were the brutal persecutions of the Germans in Poland. In addition, the other minority population groups, notably Ukrainians, were subjected to a fate that was no less severe. During those days in August 1939, when the Polish attitude steadily hardened, thanks to Britain's blank check of unlimited backing, the German Reich was moved to make one final proposal. We were prepared to enter into negotiations with Poland on the basis of this proposal, and we verbally informed the British ambassador of the proposal text. Today, I would like to recall that proposal and review it with you. Text of the German proposal of August 29, 1939. Proposal for a settlement of the Danzig corridor problem and the German-Polish minority question. The situation between the German Reich and Poland is now such that any further incident could lead to action by the military forces that have taken position on both sides of the frontier. Any peaceful solution must be such that the basic causes of this situation are eliminated so that they are not simply repeated, which would mean that not only Eastern Europe, but other areas as well, would be subject to the same tension. The causes of this situation are rooted in, first, the intolerable border that was specified by the dictated Peace of Versailles of 1919, and second, the intolerable treatment of the minority populations in the lost territories. In making these proposals, the German Reich government is motivated by the desire to achieve a permanent solution that will put an end to the intolerable situation arising from the present border demarcation, secure to both parties vitally important connecting routes, and which will solve the minority problem insofar as that is possible? And if not, will at least ensure a tolerable life for the minority populations with secure guarantees of their rights? The German Reich government is convinced that it is absolutely necessary to investigate the economic and physical damage inflicted since 1918, with full reparations to be made for that. Of course, it regards this obligation as binding on both sides. On the basis of these considerations, we make the following concrete proposals. 1. The Free City of Danzig returns immediately to the German Reich on the basis of its purely German character and the unanimous desire of its population. 2. The territory of the so-called Polish Corridor will decide for itself whether it wishes to belong to Germany or to Poland. This territory consists of the area between the Baltic Sea in the north to a line marked in the south by the towns of Marienwerder, Graudenz, Kuhn, and Bromberg, including these towns, and then westward to Schoenlanke. 3. For this purpose, a plebiscite will be conducted in this territory. All Germans who lived in this territory on January 1, 1918, or were born there on or before that date will be entitled to vote in the plebiscite. Similarly, all Poles, Kashubians, and so forth who lived in this territory on or before that date or were born there before that date will also be entitled to vote. Germans who were expelled from this territory will return to vote in the plebiscite. To ensure an impartial plebiscite, and to make sure that all necessary preliminary preparation work is properly carried out, this territory will come under the authority of an international commission similar to the one organized in the Saar territory for the 1935 plebiscite there. This commission is to be organized immediately by the four great powers of Italy, the Soviet Union, France, and Britain. This commission will have all sovereign authority in the territory. Accordingly, Polish military forces, Polish police, and Polish authorities are to clear out of this territory as soon as possible by a date to be agreed upon. 4. Not included in this territory is the Polish port of Gdynia, which is regarded as a fundamentally sovereign Polish territory to the extent of the ethnic Polish settlement, but as a matter of principle is recognized as Polish territory. The specific borders of this Polish port city will be negotiated by Germany and Poland and, if necessary, established by an international court of arbitration. 5. In order to ensure ample time for the preparations necessary in order to conduct an impartial plebiscite, the plebiscite will not take place until after at least 12 months have elapsed. 6. In order to ensure unhindered traffic between Germany and East Prussia and between Poland and the Baltic Sea during this period before the plebiscite, certain roads and rail lines may be designated to enable free transit. In that regard, only such fees may be imposed that are necessary for the maintenance of the transit routes or for transport itself. 7. A simple majority of the votes cast will decide whether the territory will go to Germany or to Poland. 8. After the plebiscite has been conducted, and regardless of the result, free transit will be guaranteed between Germany and its province of Danzig, East Prussia, as well as between Poland and the Baltic Sea. If the plebiscite determines that the territory belongs to Poland, Germany will obtain an extraterritorial transit zone consisting of a motor superhighway, Reichsautobahn, and a four-track rail line approximately along the line of Butwau, Danzig, and Dirschau. The highway and the rail line will be built in such a way that the Polish transit lines are not disturbed, which means that they will pass either above or underneath. This zone will be 1 kilometer wide and will be sovereign German territory. In case the plebiscite is in Germany's favor, Poland will have free and unrestricted transit to its port of Gdynia with the same right to an extraterritorial road and rail line that the Germans would have had. 9. If the corridor returns to Germany and the German Reich declares that it is ready to carry out an exchange of population with Poland to the extent that this would be suitable for the people of the corridor. 10. The special rights that may be claimed by Poland in the port of Danzig will be negotiated on the basis of parity for rights to Germany in the port of Gdynia. 11. In order to eliminate all fears of threat from either side, Danzig and Gdynia will be purely commercial centers, that is, with no military installations or military fortifications. 12. The peninsula of Hela, which will go either to Poland or Germany on the basis of the plebiscite, will be demilitarized in any case. 13. The German Reich government has protested in the strongest terms against the Polish treatment of its minority populations. For its part, the Polish government also believes itself called upon to make protest against Germany. Accordingly, both sides agree to submit these complaints to an international investigation commission which will be responsible for investigating all complaints of economic and physical damage, as well as other acts of terror. Germany and Poland pledged to compensate for all economic and other damages inflicted on minority populations on both sides since 1918, and to revoke all expropriations and provide for complete reparations for the victims of these and other economic measures. 14. In order to eliminate feelings of deprivation of international rights in the part of the Germans who will remain in Poland, as well as of the Poles who will remain in Germany, and above all, to ensure that they are not forced to act contrary to their ethnic national feelings, Germany and Poland agreed to guarantee the rights of the minority populations on both sides through comprehensive and binding agreements. These will ensure the right of these minority groups to maintain, freely develop, and carry on their national cultural life. In particular, they will be allowed to maintain organizations for these purposes. Both sides agree that members of their minority populations will not be drafted for military service. 15. If agreement is reached on the basis of these proposals, Germany and Poland declare that they will immediately order and carry out the demobilization of their armed forces. 16. Germany and Poland will agree to whatever additional measures may be necessary to implement the above points as quickly as possible. End of the text of the German proposal. The same measures would have applied with regard to the proposals to secure the rights of the minorities. This is the treaty proposal as straightforward and as generous as has ever been presented by a government that was made by the National Socialist leadership of the German Reich. The former Polish government refused to respond to these proposals in any way. In this regard, the question presents itself: how is it possible that such an unimportant state could dare to simply disregard such proposals and, in addition, carry out further cruelties against the Germans, the people who had given this land its entire culture, and even order the general mobilization of its armed forces? Well, absolutely, the answer is that Rosenfeld and Churchill gave Poland a blank check and said, don't negotiate with Germany under any circumstances.
Well, right. They promised Poland that they would protect Poland, and actually...
They gave more than Stalin.
Well, right. When war came, it came so suddenly into such, you know, a destruction of Poland that they never... that they were just idiots for believing the British is basically what it boils down to. It was like the little kid that other kids pump up in order to hit some other kid, and the other kid just whips his butt, right?
And they sit there laughing.
They sit there laughing because they all had a good time.
They tell some third grader to go pick a fight with a sixth grader, and they say they'll back him up, and they just sit there laughing while he gets pummeled.
Right.
So I'm sure Churchill was laughing. Stalin was laughing, and if Rosenfeld hadn't died and gone to hell in 45 before the war ended and Poland got handed over to the Soviets, he'd have been laughing too that the Poles had been duped royally. They were expecting an independent, free Poland, but they didn't get that. But I have no doubt that had Poland sided with Germany, Germany would have had a much easier time going into the Soviet Union, because they'd have been probably 400 or 600 miles closer to Moscow for their, you know, jumping off point for their attack on the Soviet Union. So if Poland had actually allied with Germany, they could have destroyed the Soviet Union. Since Poland had about a million man army, and the Poles had fought a war against the Soviets in 1921, hadn't they?
Well, absolutely. And then Poland wouldn't have suffered for 40 years under the Soviet regime after the war. Poland and the rest of the Eastern Europe. There's another article that talks about Poland that I have here. It's Poland Censored Holocaust by Mark Rowland. And I'm just going to read the introduction to it. I'm not going to get into the article. We should probably cover that one day, too. But Mark Rowland asks, why in the world would Adolf Hitler risk war with the greatest continental military powers of his era, France, Britain, and the Soviet Union, just to grab a piece of Poland? Mainstream historians say his motives were psychopathic, i.e. Hitler was a madman bent on a war. But, well, that was really true of Roosevelt and Churchill, right? And the Jews. And we know they're the history's greatest psychopaths. Rowland continues, but these court historians are leaving a very important piece out of the story. Is it possible that Hitler's inexplicable decision to attack Poland was based on the highest moral grounds and altruistic goals. Could a man like Adolf Hitler sit by while his fellow countrymen in Poland were slaughtered? More than 59,000 in 1939 alone. Time had come to act. Hitler was forced into the war with Poland. England just sat there and drooled and over the thought of destroying Germany, because they were all and absolutely perverted by Jewish propaganda.
Absolutely, and if you think about it, what did the British do for the Rhodesians when Mugabe's boys were blowing up airplanes and setting off bombs and planting landmines? They didn't say, oh my God, you're our cousins in Rhodesia, we're going to send the British SAS in there, we're going to send in infantry, we're going to help you, we're going to save your lives. They said, oh, we're going to put sanctions against you, you're an irresponsible white minority evil regime, and covertly the British gave weapons and funding to Mugabe, where if thousands of German colonists were being killed in Africa by communists and Hitler had anything to say about it, he'd have sent the SS in there to straighten the situation out and protect the Germans. So the British, how did they thank all these little colonies that fought for them? You know, the Rhodesians had the hundreds of pilots, probably at least dozens of pilots. The South Africans sent hundreds of pilots to help the Royal Air Force. They sent multiple divisions and regiments from Rhodesia and South Africa. And what did the British do to thank them?
That they sold them all out to the aliens that whose lands they were invested in. They sold them all out.
And I'm sure if they could have sold out Canada, New Zealand, and Australia somehow, they'd have done that too. But there weren't enough aliens in those countries, so they had to import them there.
Right. They're still importing Haitians and Jamaicans in Canada.
Would you like
in
to
large
take for now? Or?
Yeah. Yes, with regard to Germany's relationship with America, the following should be said.
Oh, there's a paragraph above that.
Oh, okay. I thought I'm in the wrong place then. Potocki, I have a paper from the writings of Count Jerzy Potocki, and Hitler mentions him here. And yeah, you know, I have a ton of documents that we could cover yet that very well explain every little facet of the true history between of the beginnings of World War II, and they will all vindicate Adolf Hitler 100%. A look at the documents of the Polish Foreign Ministry in Warsaw later provided a surprising explanation. They told the role of a man, President Roosevelt, who, with diabolical lack of principle, used all of his influence to strengthen Poland's resistance and to prevent any possibility of understanding. These reports were sent by the Polish ambassador in Washington, Count Jerzy Potocki, to his government in Warsaw. These documents clearly and shockingly reveal the extent to which one man and the powers behind him are responsible for the Second World War. Another question arises. Why had this man, Roosevelt, developed such a fanatic hostility against the country that, in its entire history, had never harmed either America or him? Well, maybe because America wasn't where his real allegiances lied, right?
Absolutely.
With regard to Germany's relationship with America, the following should be said. One, Germany is perhaps the only great power which has never had a colony in either North or South America, nor has it been otherwise politically active there, apart from the emigration of many millions of Germans with their skills, from which the American continent, and particularly the United States, has only benefited. I'd like to say that nearly 50% of the population of this country, of the white population of this country, is of German extraction, myself included. Two, in the entire history of the development and existence of the United States, the German Reich has never been hostile or even politically unfriendly towards the United States. To the contrary, many Germans have given their lives to defend the United States. Three, the German Reich has never participated in wars against the United States except when the United States went to war against it in 1917. It did so for reasons that have been thoroughly explained by a commission, a special U.S. Senate investigating committee, 1934-1935, chaired by Senator Gerald Nye, which President Roosevelt himself established. This commission was to investigate the reasons for America's entry into the First World War, clearly established that the United States entered the war in 1917 solely for the capitalist interests of a small group, and that Germany itself had no intention to come into conflict with America. Let me say that Gerald Nye was one of the better Senate men we've had in the Senate. Furthermore, there are no territorial or political conflicts between the American and German nations that could possibly involve the existence or even the interest of the United States. According to the Jews, Hitler wanted to take over the whole world, right? Hmm. And we'd all be speaking German.
Instead of all speaking Ebonics and bastardized Spanish.
Right. And Hitler did not set the Reichstag fire. That was absolutely, you're absolutely wrong on that, Doomdog. Furthermore, there are no territorial or political conflicts between the American and German nations that could possibly involve the existence or even the vital interests of the United States. The forms of government have always been different, but this cannot be a reason for hostility between different nations as long as one form of government does not try to interfere with another outside of its naturally ordained sphere. America is a republic led by a president with wide-ranging powers of authority. Germany was once ruled by a monarchy with limited authority, and then by a democracy that lacked authority, the Weimar Republic, right? Today it is a republic of wide-ranging authority. Between these two countries is an ocean. If anything, the differences between capitalist America and Bolshevik Russia, if these terms have any meaning at all, must be more significant than those between America led by a president and Germany led by a Führer. It is a fact that the two historical conflicts between Germany and the United States were stimulated by two Americans, that is, by Presidents Woodrow Wilson and Franklin Roosevelt, although each was inspired by the same forces. History itself has rendered its verdict on Wilson. His name will always be associated with the most base betrayal in history of a pledge, notably Wilson's 14 points. The result was
he pledged that he would keep us out of the war, and as soon as he got elected, he got us into the war.
Well, absolutely. The result was the ruin of national life, not only of the so-called vanquished countries, but among the victors as well. Because of this broken pledge, which alone made impossible the imposed Treaty of Versailles, countries were torn apart, cultures were destroyed, and the economic life of all was ruined. Today we know that a group of self-serving financiers stood behind Wilson. They used this paralytic professor to lead America into a war from which they hoped to profit. The German nation believed this man and had to pay for this trust with political and economic ruin. Actually, Germany never lost a battle in World War I on German territory. They agreed to a truce, and as soon as Germany disarmed, it got everything that it never expected, right?
It didn't get a truce. It got a Carthaginian peace.
Yes, it did. I have an article about the Reichstag fire on the Mein Kampf site. The Nazis definitely did not set the Reichstag fire. That is Jewish propaganda. When the hell are Christians ever going to stop falling for Jewish propaganda? It is simply beyond me. It's totally unthinking. After such a bitter experience, why is there now another American president who is determined to incite wars and, above all, to stir up hostility against Germany to the point of war? National Socialism came to power in Germany in the same year that Roosevelt came to power in the United States. Well, of course, the Jews put Roosevelt in power and declared war on Germany, right? That's Roosevelt's real motive. At this point, it is important to examine the factors behind the current developments. First of all, the personal side of things. I understand very well that there is a world of difference between my outlook on life and attitude and that of President Roosevelt. Roosevelt came from an extremely wealthy family. By birth and origin, he belonged to that class of people that is privileged in a democracy and is assured of advancement. I myself was only the child of a small and poor family, was only the child of a small and poor family. He had a brother and sister. And I had to struggle through life by work and effort in spite of immense hardships. As a member of the privileged class, Roosevelt experienced the First World War in a position under Wilson's shadow as Assistant Secretary of the Navy. As a result, he only knew the agreeable consequences of a conflict between nations from which some profited while others lost their lives. During the same period, I lived very differently. I was not one of those who made history or profits, but rather one of those who carried out orders. As an ordinary soldier during those 4 years, I tried to do my duty in the face of the enemy. Of course, I returned from the war just as poor as when I had entered in the fall of 1914. I thus shared my fate with millions of others, while Mr. Roosevelt shared his with the so-called upper 10,000. The scum rises to the top. After the war, while Mr. Roosevelt tested his skills in financial speculation in order to profit personally from the inflation, that is, from the misfortune of others, I still lay in a military hospital along with many hundreds of thousands of others. Experienced in business, financially secure, and enjoying the patronage of his class, Roosevelt finally chose a career in politics. During this same period, I struggled as a nameless and unknown man for the rebirth of my nation, which was the victim of the greatest injustice in its entire history. Two different paths in life. Franklin Roosevelt took power in the United States as the candidate of a thoroughly capitalistic party, which helps those who serve it. When I became the Chancellor of the German Reich, I was the leader of a popular national movement, which I had created myself. The powers that supported Mr. Roosevelt were the same powers I fought against, out of concern for the fate of my people and out of the deepest inner conviction. The brain trust that served the new American president was made up of members of the same national group that we fought against in Germany as a parasitical expression of humanity and which began to remove from public life. And in other words, Roosevelt had all Jewish advisors, or for the most part, Jewish advisors.
And he did.
Yes, he did. And like, Hitler knew it, and Hitler knew their nature.
Like Morgenthau. Isn't that where they got the Morgenthau plan? To destroy Germany?
Well, absolutely. And that's exactly what Morgenthau wanted. That Morgenthau was responsible for handing, was one of the ones responsible for handing Eastern Europe over to the Soviets.
They were even circulating plans in the late 20s and early 30s for the possibility of a war with Germany and how to destroy the German nation by sterilizing all the men, sterilizing, you know, the majority of the women, and moving Germans in the cities and destroying their farmland. They were talking about how many millions they could starve. They were circulating all kinds of studies on the matter, saying that if they would destroy Germany's irrigation system and their agricultural infrastructure, they could starve 20 million people to death in several months.
Well, it's an open plot by the Jews to destroy all of white Christianity, and white people don't see it. They refuse to open their eyes. The Jews are God's chosen people. How could they do anything wrong?
Well, what was it that KGB defector Bezmenov said? He said they don't understand until the Iron Boot comes crashing down on them, and then they're on their way to the gulag, and it's too late.
And yet, we also had something in common. Franklin Roosevelt took control of the country with an economy that had been ruined as a result of democratic influences, or Jewish central banks. And I assumed the leadership of a Reich that was also on the edge of complete ruin, thanks to democracy. There were 13 million unemployed in the United States, while Germany had 7 million unemployed and another 7 million part-time workers. In both countries, public finances were in chaos, and it seemed that the spreading economic depression could not be stopped. From then on, things developed in the United States and in the German Reich in such a way that future generations will have no difficulty in making a definitive evaluation of the two different socio-political theories. Whereas the German Reich experienced an enormous improvement in social, economic, and cultural and artistic life in just a few years under the National Socialist leadership, President Roosevelt was not able to bring about even limited improvements in his own country. This task should have been so much easier in the United States, with barely 15 people per square kilometer, as compared to 140 in Germany. If economic prosperity is not possible in that country, it must be the result of either a lack of will by the ruling leadership or the complete incompetence of the men in charge. I would say it was both. In just 5 years, the economic problems were solved in Germany, and unemployment was eliminated. During this time period, President Roosevelt enormously increased his country's national debt, devalued the dollar, further disrupted the economy, and maintained the same number of unemployed. The difference is that the Jews were ransacking the United States, and Hitler had thrown the wolves out of the sheepfold. But this is hardly remarkable when one realizes that the intellects appointed by this man, or more accurately, who appointed him, are members of that same group who, as Jews, are interested only in disruption and never in order. While we in National Socialist Germany took measures against financial speculation, it flourished tremendously under Roosevelt. The New Deal legislation of this man was spurious and consequently the greatest error ever experienced by anyone. If his economic policies had continued indefinitely during peacetime, there is no doubt sooner or later that they would have brought down this president in spite of all his dialectical cleverness. In a European country, his career would certainly have ended in front of a national court for recklessly squandering his nation's wealth, and he would hardly have avoided a prison sentence by a civil court for criminally incompetent business management. Well, the American media still holds him up as a hero because he destroyed the evil German, that evil German Christian nation, right?
Haven't you heard he's the greatest president ever?
Absolutely. It's the greatest president for the Jews that own the media, right? That's exactly what he is. Okay. Many respected Americans also shared this view. A threatening opposition was growing all around this man, which led him to think that he could save himself only by diverting public attention from his domestic policies to foreign affairs. In this regard, it is interesting to study the reports of Polish Ambassador Potocki from Washington, which repeatedly point out that President Roosevelt was fully aware of the danger that his entire economic house of cards could collapse, and that therefore he absolutely had to divert attention to foreign policy. The circle of Jews around Roosevelt encouraged him in this. With Old Testament vindictiveness, they regarded the United States as the instrument that they and he could use to prepare a second Purim against the nations of Europe, which were increasingly anti-Jewish. And we've pointed out that the nations of Eastern Europe, before the years leading up to World War II, had actually began to identify the devils and excoriate them, right? So it was that the Jews, in all of their satanic baseness, gathered around this man, and he relied on them. The American president increasingly used his influence to create conflicts, intensifying existing conflicts, and above all, to keep conflicts from being resolved peacefully. For years, this man looked for dispute anywhere in the world, but preferably in Europe, that he could use to create political entanglements with American economic obligations to one of the contending sides, which would then steadily involve America in the conflict and thus divert attention from his own confused domestic economic policies. His actions against the German Reich in this regard had been particularly blunt. Starting in 1937, he began a series of speeches, including a particularly contemptible one on October 5th, 1937 in Chicago, with which this man systematically incited the American public against Germany. He threatened to establish a kind of quarantine against the so-called authoritarian countries. As part of this steady and growing campaign of hate and incitement, President Roosevelt made another insulting statement on November 15, 1938, and then called the American ambassador in Berlin back to Washington for consultations. Since then, the two countries have been represented only by Chargés d'Affaires. Starting in November 1938, he began systematically and consciously to sabotage every possibility of European peace policy. In public, he hypocritically claimed to be interested in peace, while at the same time he threatened every country that was ready to pursue a policy of peaceful understanding by blocking credits, economic reprisals, calling in loans, and so forth. In this regard, the reports of the Polish ambassadors in Washington, London, Paris, and Brussels provide a shocking insight. This man increased his campaign for incitement in January 1939. In a message to the U.S. Congress, he threatened to take every measure short of war against the authoritarian countries. He repeatedly claimed that other countries were trying to interfere in American affairs, and he talked a lot about upholding the Monroe Doctrine. Starting in March 1939, he began lecturing about internal European affairs that were of no concern for the President of the United States. In the first place, he doesn't understand these problems, and secondly, even if he did understand them and appreciated the historical circumstances, he has no more right to concern himself with Central European affairs than the German head of state has to take positions or make judgments about conditions in the United States.
The Germans never did that.
Absolutely.
So the Zimmerman note, that was just a bunch of bunk.
Well, the Zimmerman note was an English counterfeit.
Absolutely. The British basically wanted to get America into the war, so they used that as a casus belli to lure us in for World War One, and then they used Poland as basically a sacrificial lamb, or rather a sacrificial sheeple, to start World War II.
Even if the Zimmerman note was true, it was laughable.
All right, and you think we should end soon or keep rolling, or do you want to pick up from here next week?
Okay, we could stop here. I mean, we're probably going to double back anyway, and we're never going to finish this tonight. We'll double back next week, and I'll mark this off.
And you said you had a few articles you want to bring in next week, too.
Yes.
And I'd like
Absolutely.
To possibly talk about Operation Barbarossa, and I may want to get into Hitler's speech on why he went to war with the Soviet Union.
Well, that would be next, and then we'll discuss Operation Barbarossa. I have a lot of material on Barbarossa from both the Barnes Review and from Suvorov.
Excellent. Okay, great. Yahweh bless.
Praise Yahweh. Thank you.